132. NBA, Bucks were off last night. Bulls lose to Toronto, 113-104. Tonight, the Bucks play the Hawks in Atlanta. The Bulls host the Raptors. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, November 7th. Sunny and windy, seasonal temperatures, a high of 51, some winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, wind west at 7, 39 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Halloween was 1 week ago, and 7 days after the fact, the Morning Show is catching up with a Morning Show interview devoted to monsters, specifically monsters in the movies. I'm excited to share this interview out of the archives with local author James Niebuhr, which was recorded and initially broadcast several years ago. That is monster music. That is monster movie music, specifically. This is music of Franz Waxman, from the score to one of the greatest monster movies of all time, The Bride of Frankenstein. And this is one of a number of different movies that we are going to be discussing over the next few minutes with James Niebuhr, who is a familiar name to many of you and certainly a familiar name to loyal Morning Show listeners, because I've had the pleasure of speaking with James Niebuhr on several different occasions about some of the books that he has written about the marvelous world of movies. He has been a movie connoisseur for many, many years and written extensively on a number of different important actors and directors and genres. The particular book we're going to be talking about today is called The Monster Movies of Universal Studios. And when we are talking about this particular lineup of films, we are talking about some of the towering classics like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Invisible Man, and so on. And as usual, James Niebuhr has done exhaustive research and thoroughly examines each and every one of these classic films, as well as their many sequels. And along the way, we end up sort of coming to terms with the intriguing question of why it is that we are drawn to monster movies again and again. Well, maybe not all of us, but a lot of us are. Again, this book is called The Monster Movies of Universal Studios, published by Roman and Littlefield. And James Niebuhr, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
It's great to be back. It's always good to visit you, Greg.
Right. And we should say that you are a local author, but personal circumstances prevent you from actually coming to the studio today. But even over the phone, I'm delighted to be speaking with you, especially about as interesting a book as this. Before we delve into the book, I want you to briefly recap for our listeners kind of the story of how you became so feverishly interested in the world of movies. At what point in your life did this happen and how?
Oh, sure. I was just a real little kid, and it's just after the assassination of President Kennedy. My parents, you know, there was nothing on TV the following weekend, except for coverage of that terrible event. And so my parents took me to see my first movie, and it was a movie called Who's Minding the Store, starring Jerry Lewis, at one of the beautiful downtown theaters in Racine, Wisconsin, which unfortunately is not there anymore. And it was this big, beautiful, ornate building, and we had to sit up way in the balcony because the theater was packed, you know, nothing on TV, everybody went to the movies. And they really needed some escape after this terrible national event that had happened with the assassination. Well, my young mind heard all these people just rocking in their seats with laughter at the silly stuff that's going on the screen, and my young mind also realized that during a very sad time, this goofy guy, Jerry Lewis, was making everybody happy. And I connected with that. Like, there's a magic to film, especially comedy film. And that became something of an interest. And even though I had a pretty ordinary childhood with, you know, friends and school and playing outside and everything else, in my spare time, I would look at books, whatever was written, not much back then, that talked about movie history. And when older movies were on television, I would gravitate towards them at different genres. In fact, the book we're talking about today, the old monster movies I was watching probably by the following year in like first grade because they were so popular on television. And, you know, fast forward later on, not only did I do a book on Jerry Lewis, which I interviewed him, and in fact, we became friends. I was actually invited to the private memorial when he passed away, invited by his family. But I also ended up doing a book on the monster movies, which is my latest.
And it is a great book. And I wonder, I suspect that the vast majority of books that you write are books in which you are coming at the topic, be it a genre or be it a particular person, as a fan, as an admirer. But obviously it would be possible for someone who doesn't particularly enjoy monster movies to nevertheless write a really good book about them. My sense, though, is from reading this book that you very much enjoy these films.
Yeah, it would be very difficult for me to write. I guess I could objectively appreciate movies that didn't particularly interest me on a subjective level, but I don't think it would be really a whole lot of fun to do that, so I would never approach a topic like that. And my interests are very wide. As you know, I've written books on everybody from Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton to Jerry Lewis and Elvis Presley to Clint Eastwood and Jack Nicholson. So a book on monster movies is something that I was a fan of ever since childhood, and you might recall, I'd say right around 1970, WGN Television out of Chicago had a program on Saturday nights called Creature Features, and they used Henry Mancini's music, Experiment in Terror, as the theme, and they would show the Universal Monster films every Saturday night. And that's when I really, like, saw everything, all of them. They weren't random viewings when they would haphazardly come on TV. It was a weekly series of films. And so every Saturday night, they were there. And that's when we got to see most of them.
Explain a little bit about Universal Studios itself. That is the movie studio that is responsible for these great classic monster movies, as well as the various sequels that you explore. It's an interesting company with an interesting history. Sketch that for us and also maybe tell us why it made sense that they are the company that brought these particular films to the world. What was it about Universal Studios that sort of made this sort of a logical thing for them to do?
Oh, sure. Universal Studios was founded in the very, very early days of movies, you know, chiefly by Carl Lamelay. And I think they started right around 1912 or so. And that's the very early days of film. And they started to have probably their strongest success when an actor by the name of Lon Chaney, who was later known as the Man of a Thousand Faces because of the different makeup he would apply. And he was making films in the very early 1920s. And just about everybody's heard of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera, two projects that have lived on through several remakes. And, of course, Phantom of the Opera had that magnificent Broadway musical many decades later. Well, this was the foundation, and Lon Chaney was just a huge superstar of the silent era. Well, by the end of the 1920s, Lamellais' son, Carl Lamellais Jr., became head of production. And he had more innovative and daring ideas than his father, and it was him that decided to produce an all-color musical. A color film in 1930 is pretty amazing. That's the early days of sound movies, let alone color. It was called King of Jazz, and it starred the band leader Paul Whiteman. And he also was behind the production of All Quiet on the Western Front, which was the first sound movie to win Best Picture at the Academy Awards. Well, he decided to film the Bram Stoker novel Dracula, and he was, of course, going to have Lon Chaney play the title role. Well, some of his ideas, innovative ideas for other films, weren't quite that lucrative. And as a result, on top of that, in 1929, the Depression hit with the stock market crash. So the lavish plans he had for Dracula had to be pared down. So instead of a big budget production of the novel, he decided to film a stage play, which was running at that time, based on the novel and written by or adapted by Hamilton Dean. Well, Lon Chaney passed away during pre-production in 1930. And so the actor who was in the stage play, a guy named Bela Lugosi, who had done a few films in his native Hungary, lobbied really hard to get the part, even to the point of saying he would only take a very small salary. And so he ended up getting the part. And, of course, the rest is history. It's hard to believe that Bela Lugosi only played Dracula in two movies his entire career, the original classic and years later in the an Abbott and Costello movie, though only two times. And still, whenever somebody does an impression of Dracula, it's always the voice of that Bela Lugosi. It's always that infected delivery that we're so aware of, because he really identified with the part so completely and made it his own.
Mm. And as far as we know, was it the great success of that film, Dracula, in 1931, that very directly inspired the films that came after? Or were the films that came after already on the drawing board and already in process?
Well, actually, Dracula became such of an enormous hit that the studio just figured, well, hey, let's do the Mary Shelley book Frankenstein. That'd be maybe another success. And what's cool about the Frankenstein movie, along with it being an absolute classic, is that the makeup that was created for Boris Karloff, who played the monster, with the square head and the bolts on either side of the neck, that wasn't in the original novel at all. That makeup was created by Jack Pierce at Universal Studios. So whenever we think of the Frankenstein monster, the character we think of, the makeup for that character, the appearance of that character, was created by the makeup man at Universal Studios for this movie. And the success of that one just resulted in sequels like Bride of Frankenstein, for which you played some of the soundtrack. And also the next monster movie they made, The Mummy, was not from literary source material. They started making original ideas from screenwriters and stories for the movie specifically. So that's really how it all started.
Mm.
Inspired by the literature, achieving success, and then finally, okay, well, let's hire some screenwriters to make more of these because they're making a heck of a lot of money here.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Nyberg about one of his most recent books called The Monster Movies of Universal Studios. And in this book, James Nyberg explores some of the great classic monster movies of all time that are still very much a potent part of our culture. Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy, the Invisible Man, and many, many more. James, I don't think I managed to ask you this as we were beginning, but and I know this isn't the primary focus of your book, but I'm just curious, how common were monster movies before the advent of sound? Were there a significant number of monster movies during the silent era, and did they have any foothold with the public at all? Or was it really with the dawn of the films that we're talking about here that monster movies became the sort of powerful genre that we now think of?
Well, actually, there are many silent classics in the horror genre that are the foundation of the films we talk about here. But the very, very earliest movies, the really experimental ones, there was a French filmmaker named Georges Méliès who tried like little things with film to see what he could do. He was a magician, and he was very interested in the visual of cinema. Of course, these are silent movies, and back then they were only experiments. There was really no narrative plot to movies at first. It would be like if I handed you a photograph, a still photograph of a train, and the train suddenly started moving and stopped and let passengers out right on the photograph you were holding in your hand. It would be like, wow, nobody would ask, where's the color and the special effects in the story? They'd just be surprised that the picture moved, moving pictures. So during that early time, Georges Méliès would try things like have a guy stand there, turn off the camera, have the guy walk away, and then turn the camera back on, and it would look like he disappeared. And audiences, not realizing how that was done, would completely freak out, like, how did you do that? And that's the very first stuff that was kind of scary and shocking to them, how film could change the concept of living, of the world. Then early in the teens, they tried some experimental stuff with some of the monsters that had come from literature. There was a Frankenstein film made way back in 1910, and the only existing print of the film was found in the collection of a movie collector in Milwaukee, of all places.
Wow.
And when he realized he had such of a rare item, he had it transferred to safety stock and like 1,000 copies made up. So it's still pretty elusive, but at least he was smart enough to preserve it. The man has since died, but at least he was smart enough to preserve it. And for a while there would be like, they would show the Boris Karloff Frankenstein, and before that, the silent one in local showings. Because the guy would arrange to have, you know, one of his copies be screened ahead of time, because the original is probably only about 10 minutes long and probably was kind of in pretty rough shape, you know, because it hadn't been restored, because back then there wasn't a lot of restoration elements like they can do now. But there was a foundation there. And then, of course, the Lon Chaney movies. And in other countries, there was films like the very first Dracula movie, Nosferatu, which I'm sure you've heard of, the classic silent, and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is the first film to have off-kilter set design and stuff that looks spooky and murky. So horror really did have a foundation in silent movies before the sound classics were produced.
What was it like for you to revisit some of these films and to watch them? I suspect that at least some of these films you hadn't seen in quite some time. And I don't know, some of these more obscure films, some of the sequels, I wonder if you'd ever seen them before you actually set about researching the book.
Well, I have seen them, but there were some that I hadn't seen in many years. What was most interesting is that when they're shown on TV, they're showed fairly randomly. Even a weekly series like Creature Features, which spotlights the films, did not show them in chronological order. We'd see, like, Bride of Frankenstein 1 week, The Mummy's Curse the next. It was just, they would show horror movies. No, chronological order. And that's what was fascinating to me, because for the first time, I watched these films in the order that they were made. And so I saw the evolution, or in some cases, the de-evolution of the character and the stories, because as time went on, Universal horror movies weren't these high-level A-class productions anymore. They were sequels and B-movies and low-budget and stuff like that. And in some cases, it was interesting to see how great of a movie they could make with a smaller budget. And there were some circumstances where a small budget, a lot of stock footage, and, you know, the movie was almost a thing of patches and threads, and it might have been superficially entertaining, but it was by no means could compare to some of the earlier ones. So it started to get a little assembly line towards, you know, especially towards the middle of the 1940s. But yeah, seeing them in chronological order and being able to assess them that way was probably the most exciting thing for me, having, you know, coming onto these films, having seen them several times. One other thing, though, is I watched these films on television growing up, and when I was screening them, even though we have big screen, flat screen TVs now, I screened them on DVD. For, you know, a stroke of luck, the original Dracula with Bela Lugosi was one of those films being revived at the Marcus Theaters by TCM, Turner Classic Movies. And so I attended one of those screenings, and even though it might have been the eighth or ninth time I had seen that movie in my life, it was like a whole new experience seeing it in a theater with people on the big screen. And even though that movie was over 80 years old when I was watching it with the people, and there was several young people in there that might have been seeing it for the first time, it was still scary. It was black and white and slow moving and everything else. No music in the background for a lot of the scenes. And it was still scary even to the younger people. I mean, the shocking endings, people were startled, people were mesmerized, and it really had an impact that I was able to tap into how it must have been like when these movies were brand new and people were seeing them for the first time. And I mean, Frankenstein, people were running out of the theater screaming. And for the Wolfman, I believe it was, they had contests where if you can come in and watch this movie in our theater all alone at midnight, you'll win something. Because these movies were very frightening at the time. So seeing it in that venue was really like another level of right. experience for me.
One of the intriguing things as we read through your book is how the names of certain iconic actors come up again and again. And it would seem that Universal Studios at this time had a stable of very, very effective actors when it came to these kind of monster films. And, of course, we're talking about people like Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney, although we need to say Lon Chaney Jr., since, as you already have mentioned, Lon Chaney Sr. died just before the first Dracula film was made that was supposed to have starred him. Just say a word about these actors and the various roles they took, the way in which they would sort of step in and out of different roles and occasionally even be playing opposite one another. Just assess for us this remarkable group of actors that form the heart and soul of so many of these films.
No, sure. Bela Lugosi became very known as Dracula when he played the role, but he wasn't essentially typecast because, the very next year he was appearing in a W.C. Fields comedy over at Paramount Studios. So worked in, and had done other things. And when Boris Karloff came to Frankenstein, he was a serious dramatic actor. One of the great performances he did is in a movie with Edward G. Robinson about the newspaper business and yellow journalism called Five Star Final is the name. I get mixed up sometimes. Mm-hmm. Five Star Final is the name of the movie. And that was over at Warner Brothers. But when he played the Frankenstein monster, the problem with that is they wanted Lugosi to play the monster, but he didn't like the idea of playing a character so heavily made up so as to obscure him physically, and he had no dialogue. So he's like, what would I be doing there? You can get a robot or something. Unfortunately, he didn't have the foresight to realize what an actor could do with the role, which is what Karloff did. And Karloff really brought that character to life, really conveyed an emotion from the character. Even the scene with where he's sitting with the little girl and throwing flowers in the water and watching them float. And they, when they run out of flowers, he picks up the little girl and throws her in, expecting her to float. And he's doing that innocently, but it's still a terrible, gruesome act. He drowned a child. That scene was so shocking when the movie came out that grown men could be heard audibly weeping in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that film was re-released later on, that scene was cut. And it didn't, when I grew up watching the movie on television, that scene was edited out. We never see that happen. I only read about it in like monster magazines, monster movie magazines and stuff. And it wasn't until fairly recently that the scene was restored so we could see it again and see the movie as it was originally intended. So, but Karloff continued to do other things also afterwards. And then Lon Chaney Jr., who came along years later playing the Wolfman, also had a really extensive career that lasted a long time. He was in movies with Abbott and Costello, and he was in High Noon with Gary Cooper. So these were actors proper who played a lot of different roles, and they're identified with these roles because these films have had an enormous impact and have lived on, and they did so well in the characters. But what's also interesting is that they would change up. Boris Karloff, after Son of Frankenstein, didn't want to play the character anymore. He felt that everything he could do with that character had been done. And as an actor, he wants to be challenged in other roles. Bela Lugosi played it in a movie called Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And he finally was able to convey what he did with the character, which is fascinating. They promised him that the character would have dialogue in that movie, and dialogue was indeed in the script and filmed, but they decided that it just didn't work, and they cut it out before the film was released. Lugosi was so upset that he refused to work for Universal Studios for many, many years. That's why in other horror movies in which the Dracula character appears, he doesn't play Dracula. John Carradine, who is a noted actor, of course, plays the Dracula role in House of Frankenstein and in House of Dracula. And for Ghost of Frankenstein, Lon Chaney Jr. is under the Frankenstein monster makeup. So they all pretty much took their turn playing the monster over the years.
We're speaking with James Nyber about his book, The Monster Movies of Universal Studios. This book explores some of the most iconic monster movies of all time. Films like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Wolfman, The Invisible Man, and their many and various sequels that appeared over the years. The movie even takes a look towards the very end at The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is at least related to the genre, although in some respects just a step away from it. James Nyber, tell us something about the threat of censorship that was always in the air as these kind of films were being made, particularly in the 1930s. I mean, of course, nowadays we are accustomed to pretty much a no-holds-bar approach to making films, and there can be all kinds of gore splattered all over the screen. We're, of course, talking about another time and at least somewhat more innocent time in which there were certain lines that a filmmaker was simply not permitted to cross. Tell us what kind of a challenge this posed for people trying to make frightening monster movies at the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, the early part of the 30s is what's known as the pre-code era. It's before the production code came in 1934, which caused, you know, had a lot of, like, pretty tight restrictions, like a married couple not being able to even sit on a bed together unless both feet were on the floor, things like that, even, you know, fully clothed and everything else. But before that, there was a little bit more creative freedom. That's why they could have that frightening scene where the Frankenstein monster throws the little girl into the pond, expecting her to float. Well, that's 1931. As I stated earlier, when the film was re-released after the production code around 1936 or so, and they re-released it to theaters, they had to cut that scene out. That scene was no longer part, you know, because of the production code. That would not have been allowed. And the unfortunate thing is that it was cut out of the original negative, and we didn't get to see that scene until, I think, you know, I would have to look it up. It is in my book, but I didn't memorize every figure, but I think as late as the 1990s before we finally got to see that scene. Later films, of course, that were made after the production code had to be a little more careful. Bride of Frankenstein, rather than having scary scenes, it would have oddly poignant ones, like when the Frankenstein monster is wandering in the woods, and he wanders to the cabin of the blind merchant, and the blind merchant, thinking it's just, you know, a disabled man who can't speak well, takes him in and feeds him and starts to communicate with him, and the monster actually talks and, you know, starts to speak to the blind hermit, and it's really a very moving and poignant scene. And of course, Mel Brooks just absolutely skewered it with a hilarious parody with Gene Hackman and Peter Boyle and Young Frankenstein many, many years later. But things like that were happening in the movies. They were more melodrama than horror sometimes, because the production code forced the screenwriters and the filmmakers to approach it somewhat more differently. They were still considered scary movies. There were still monsters, and there were still people getting killed. But a lot of the kills were happening in long shot and off camera. And you know, the camera would cut away, and you'd hear a yell, and then you cut back, and the person's laying there. Things like that were happening a little more, I guess we could call it artistically, in a sense that they had to be pretty artistic to work within those parameters.
Mm. Speaking of artistic, I have to say that as I was reading your book and thinking about some of these films, and even went sort of surfing the net to try to at least watch snippets from them, for instance, the first Frankenstein film, which I hadn't seen in I don't know how many years, I was really struck by how artistically rendered these films are. I mean, that the director and the designer and the whole team that created the visual look of particularly that film and the other classics as well, really seemed to go out of their way to create images that just sort of burn themselves in our memory and just have such visceral impact, and it just very different from if these films had been made by someone with not nearly so much talent or attention to detail.
Well, Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, for that matter, were directed by a guy named James Whale, who had a really keen visual sense when he made films. He was very much a master filmmaker. And the budgets were good on those movies. They were considered top-level A productions. They weren't just B movies like many years later. The sets that were designed were very ornate, and the lighting was very particular. I mean, it's very dark in the studio, and there's these occasional flashes of lightning coming from the electricity in which he's trying to bring the monster to life. And the shots that, you know, during the dialogue sequences and the lighter sequences, and the madness of the doctor who was trying to create this image, the frightening Igor, who is this ominous presence all the time. All of these things just blended to create this macabre, frightening atmosphere. And then at the same time, any of the outdoor footage, like when Frankenstein wanders off and ends up with the little girl, they're very bright and they're very tranquil looking. And then suddenly this shocking thing happens in the midst of all that. Director Whale understood how the lighting, how the framework would cause the best reaction. And that's why when we look at this big budget, you know, top level classic film of its time, we can still be impressed nearly 90 years later.
Absolutely. Your phrase in describing his work is that he created scenes that were visually arresting. And I think that is put so well, because it's as though we just don't want to tear our eyes from the screen for fear of missing yet another memorable image. And of course, that's just one facet of what makes these very first films so exceptionally fine. Say a word, if you would, about another James Whale film, the original Invisible Man film, and the fact that we're talking about some special effect challenges that had to be exceptionally challenging, especially in a time like 1933.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, James Whale also directed The Invisible Man. And even though The Mummy was a big success, Universal did want to tap into a literary source once again when they filmed The Invisible Man, because that's, of course, based on a novel by H.G. Wells. And Boris Karloff was going to play the title role, but he left production because they kept wanting to reduce his salary, because they were, you know, negotiating, you know, for the special effects, and the special effects were so expensive to produce during that time. It was so difficult to do some of that stuff then, that they had to have an entire team of people working very hard to create the visual imagery, that they wanted to reduce the salary of the lead actor. And so finally, Karloff decided to leave that production, and that's when they put him into The Mummy, because this was originally going to come after Frankenstein. Well, the project was shelved, and then in June of 1932, around June of 1932, I'm not exactly sure, they reactivated it and started working on the possibility of doing it. And that's when they hired Claude Rains in the title role, because he had such a great voice. He was stage trained and had only made one other movie at that time. He's, of course, since very well known because he was in Casablanca and other films like that. But the special effects at the time, especially where the actors got bandages over his face, and when he removes them, there's nothing. It's really, once again, I guess visually arresting is a term we could use once again, because the film is something that can't, you know, at that time, now with CGI and everything, we can understand how it was done. But at that time, it was like amazing that anybody could create such things. And the special effects team was three guys, John Fulton, John Meskel, and Frank Williams. And they would use, like, the typical stuff like wires when items were moved by the fully invisible character. But when he was partially clothed or disrobing, Claude Rains would be shot in a black velvet suit against a black velvet background, because this shot would be combined with another shot of the area of the set when the scene took place. And by using a complex matte process that combined the images and controlled the areas being exposed, the effect was successful. And that seems like so much to go through and to do and to create that it's really, really impressive, especially now that, you know, they can press a couple of buttons on a machine and make that effect.
Absolutely. The click of a mouse, and then there you go. You have the Invisible Man or whatever else there is that you want to create. Pretty amazing. Yeah. Pretty amazing. I want to make sure that we explain to our listeners that your book, is not just about these incredibly famous films like Frankenstein and Dracula and The Mummy and The Invisible Man. But it is also about all of the sequels that follow those famous first films. And occasionally there'll be a sequel like The Bride of Frankenstein that we have certainly heard of and that some would argue is absolutely the equal to the first film. But I think it's maybe even more important for us to talk about some of these other sequels that none of us have probably ever heard of or maybe not seen. I mean, a film like Dracula's Daughter, for instance. I wonder if you would maybe just say a word, first of all, about the overall quality of these films that followed the originals and maybe pick out one that you think is especially fine that is worth our checking out.
Well, a lot of them were quite good. The Mummy sequels were lower budget and B movies and were superficially entertaining, but not cinematically profound, perhaps. But Dracula's Daughter, which was made early, like 1936, was still a pretty, you know, well-budgeted production and very, very good. Interestingly, the title character was played by Gloria Holden, who lived to be a very old woman. And whenever she was asked for her autograph, and she made many films, but whenever she was asked for her autograph and somebody said, "Oh, I loved you in Dracula's Daughter," she would say, "Oh, that awful thing." Because she always felt that the part and the film was beneath her, when in fact it's one of the strongest. I would rank it pretty close to the Frankenstein and Dracula and Bride of Frankenstein as one of the best universal films of the 30s, horror films of the 30s. But years later, they started to, you know, not have as much money, and they just did pretty much assembly line products for these sequels. And they even got the idea of combining all the monsters in one movie. House of Frankenstein, for instance, features the Frankenstein monster, the Wolfman, and Dracula. They were going to put the Mummy in there, too, but they couldn't find a way to keep him in the script and, you know, keep it from being kind of convoluted. Dracula was John Carradine. The Frankenstein monster was played very, very well by Glenn Strange. Boris Karloff is in the movie, but he plays like a mad doctor type guy. He does not play the monster. And Lon Chaney Jr. is indeed in the character of the Wolfman. This idea was successful enough, but this was during World War II, and budgets were slashed for various reasons, for the war effort and so forth, and there wasn't a lot of money to do elaborate special effects. But still, the ending of House of Frankenstein, where Karloff is being dragged by the Frankenstein monster, and they walk into the woods, running away from villagers with torches, and they step into quicksand and slowly sink. That was just the most frightening thing in the world when I saw it when I was like 7 or 8 years old. So I always have a particular fondness for that movie. But what's most interesting about the sequels, I think, is long after the series had ended, because they pretty much, by the end of the war, they stopped making the monster movies. But what they were making at that time were the comedies of Abbott and Costello. And Abbott and Costello were just a huge, huge hit, starting with their first starring movie, Buck Privates, in 1941. But by 1948, they had made so many movies and tried so many things, the idea was to try something different. And so they made Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. They managed to get Bela Lugosi back to play the Dracula role, which is a huge coup. Glenn Strange was once again the Frankenstein monster. Lon Chaney Jr. agreed to play the Wolfman. All of them were in the movie, and Abbott and Costello were starring, and it was a comedy. And what was great is that the monsters never did anything funny. They stayed in character as the scary, troubled sort of characters, like the Wolfman, Larry Talbot, when he's not the Wolfman, pining over the fact that, oh, it's going to be a full moon tonight and everything else. There's this really funny line where Lon Chaney says to Lou Costello, "Do you realize that when the moon rises, I'll turn into a wolf?" And Costello says, yeah, you and 20 million other guys. So, so that's, you know, they blended the comedy and the horror so expertly that Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is every bit the classic that Frankenstein and Dracula is this many years later. Hmm. What's interesting is that when Costello saw the script, he thought it was the stupidest idea he ever heard. He goes, you don't expect us to make that, do you? And they made it. It was an enormous hit, but Costello's daughter told me when I was researching the book, I talked to her, and she said, Dad never warmed up to that movie. He never considered it a very good movie, as popular as it was.
Hmm. And, of course, your book points to the emergence of a new genre of the kind of the sci-fi creatures from outer space films that fill the 1950s, and Creature from the Black Lagoon, in some respects, is sort of a film that takes certain cues from the films we've been talking about, but is also pointing us in a new direction, modern day, and just a slightly different sensibility. I'm really glad that you include that in the book.
Well, there are other books on the horror movies that stop short of including Creature from the Black Lagoon and its two sequels. But I believed that to be another universal monster. It came much later than the others, and I will agree that those films are not the cinematic classics that Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Mummy are. But the Creature from the Black Lagoon is still a very significant movie. It's from an era that, you know, it's responding to a different era, the post-war era, the era of, you know, atomic testing and all kinds of crazy things that were going on. And it's like, you know, there are laboratories, there is a monster, it is terrorizing people, and it was scary at the time. In fact, originally, the first Creature from the Black Lagoon movie was shot in 3D, so that was another process. So it's not as sophisticated as the 3D nowadays, but that was another process that was very much 50s and something new, and widescreen and things were all starting to happen then. And so the fact that Universal, the studio that started it all, now under completely different management, nobody from back then was still with the studio anymore, they were doing monster movies again under the guise of science fiction. They didn't just do sci-fi movies like The Day the Earth Stood Still. They had a monster in theirs, and they recalled back to their foundation and said, our sci-fi movies are going to feature a major monster. And so I thought that was cool, and I thought that connected Creature from the Black Lagoon to the original series, and that's why I wanted to conclude the book with those movies.
Fantastic. The book again is called The Monster Movies of Universal Studios. It's published by Roman and Littlefield, and it's a very, very thorough and fascinating book indeed, and it covers actually 29 films in all, from Dracula to The Creature Walks Among Us, and the author, James Nybert. James Nybert, thanks so much for yet another fine book and for the chance to talk with you. I appreciate it. Best wishes.
It's always great to visit with you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to welcome into our studios for the first time Matt Hoagland, who is a colleague of mine in the music faculty at Carthage College, coordinator of music theater at Carthage, and the director of a production of one of the most important and groundbreaking, even revolutionary, musicals in history, Hair. It's about to be performed at Carthage this coming weekend, and we'll be talking about it tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Wednesday from the archives, Dr. Sandra Motes from the History Faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and we'll be talking about her book, Celebrating the Republic, which looked at the role of ceremony in the administrations of our first five presidents, George Washington through James Monroe. And Thursday's morning show will include, among other things, a conversation with Jeff Perlman about his latest book, which is called The Last Folk Hero. It's an examination of the life and career of one of the most amazing athletes of the